This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Paul Rayburn, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Several recent studies have pointed to a sharp rise in autism rates during the past 10 years. The largest study, done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says autism is 10 times as common now as it was a decade ago. This hour, we'll take a look at these reports of a rise in the autism rates. Is there really an epidemic, as some are calling it, or are we just doing a better job of diagnosing the disease? We'll also look at recent research on the genetics of autism. Scientists are sure there is a genetic component to autism and to related disorders such as Asperger's syndrome. We'll talk with a geneticist to find out whether researchers are any closer to pinpointing the genes that cause these disorders. We'll also take your questions about autism in this hour. Remember, of course, that we cannot diagnose your child or give medical advice over the radio, so please keep that in mind when you call. If you're looking for more information about what we will be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you will find a whole bunch of links to our topic. Our phone number here is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. Now I'd like to introduce my guests. Susan Folstein is the leader of the Autism Genetics Research Cooperative and a professor of psychiatry at the Tufts University School of Medicine, New England Medical Center. She joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Folstein.
My pleasure.
And Andy Schur is the director of research and programs for the National Alliance for Autism Research in Princeton. He joins us right here in our New York studios. Thanks for coming in today, Dr. Schur.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first of all, I think, Dr. Folstein, what is autism exactly? How does it differ from other similar disorders?
Well, it's we call it a developmental disorder, and it is characterized by three main features. The most important is failure to relate to other people in the usual way. That is, it never, the sort of social intuition that humans have and most animals does not develop normally.
My naive picture of autistic kids is very inward and quiet and keeping to themselves. Is that about right?
That's about right for the younger ones. As they get older, they do develop some social skills, particularly if they have a good teacher, but they're always awkward, and their social advances are so peculiar that they're usually rejected by others, even if they do develop an interest in talking to other
right.
people.
So there, you said this is the first of three identifying characteristics you were about to say?
The second important feature is what the describer of autism called an obsessive desire for the maintenance of sameness. So these children, for whatever reason, some think it's because the world is so confusing to them that if anything changes in it, it just puts them into a dither. But they like things the same. So typical examples are that the child will come home and rearrange the furniture back the way it was, or move the ashtray 2 inches to the left, or because that's where it was when he first saw it. Or in their own rooms, they may have not necessarily neat arrangements, but particular preferred arrangements. Though there are many different kinds of examples.
So that's number two.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the third feature is abnormalities in language. Now, there are really two aspects of language. One is ordinary structural language, you might call it, that is grammar and syntax and vocabulary. And this varies tremendously in autism. It can be entirely normal, as it is in Asperger's syndrome, or completely absent. But what's always, the aspect of language that's always abnormal is pragmatics. So children with autism, regardless of how able or unable they are, have a great deal of difficulty with social cues, both giving them and understanding them from other people. They usually have an abnormal lilt to their voice, and sometimes they sound kind of like a robot. But But regardless of how they sound, it's very hard for them to understand what other people mean when they say a word with a certain tone of voice. So they hear the words, but they don't hear the music. And, of course, most of the meaning is in the music.
Right. Andy Scherr, what is life like for a family that has one of these children? Or I guess some families have more than one child with autism.
Right. National Alliance for Autism Research is a parents-led organization. So through the year, I have had opportunity to work with the parents. And I think the common denominator for them is that there's a tremendous amount of suffering, a significant decrease in the quality of life for both the child as well as the parents. And in general, is one of a continuing frustration.
Very emotionally unsettling, disruptive.
Emotionally draining, yes, definitely.
Yeah. Is it now, are there a lot of medical costs associated with this condition?
Sure. I think, many children with autism require special care. Sometimes they have complications, we call comorbid conditions.
What would some of those mean?
Gastrointestinal is a common one.
Really?
For example, motor skills is another issue. So in general, the cost of caring for such a child is pretty heavy and
what is the I could imagine that motor skills might be related, but where does gastrointestinal problems come from? Is there some genetic or biological link, or why would that be a common comorbid condition?
I think it's autism definitely have a strong genetic component. What is known about autism is that the deficits and the manifestations in terms of symptoms vary tremendously from individual to individual. And you often hear parents talk about their child who do not tolerate certain types of food well and so on and so forth. So gastrointestinal difficulty is but one of the many medical complications that can be found in the population.
Right. Now, we're talking about some of the genetic components of autism. Susan Folstein, this widely publicized and discussed rise in rates of autism in some recent studies. I'm assuming that genetics hasn't changed in the past decade,
right.
So that raises a question about other something in the environment that might be a cause. Give us a bit of an explanation of what might or might not be going on with these studies.
Well, I think there are several factors that are contributing to the rise of autism, and we may not know what they all are. But there are several clear changes in how we diagnose autism. So, for example, in the manual that psychiatrists use, that lists criteria, the criteria have changed in the last 10 or 15 years so that a larger number of socially related abnormal behaviors are considered within to qualify a child for the diagnosis. So that's one thing. We are broadening our diagnostic criteria so that more children meet criteria.
So let me just emphasize that point a bit. We don't have a test or a blood test or something to detect to diagnose autism.
That's correct.
So it's, we use a,
probably
a,
we never will have
right.
a specific test because there are several different causes.
So the diagnosis you're talking about is a list, a sort of a checklist of
exactly.
Okay, and that's been modified over the years.
Right.
Okay, so it could be that is now encompassing more people as the
it,
definition.
It definitely
has changed.
Is. We know
it definitely
that
is
for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what else plays a part
mm-hmm.
in this?
The second factor in that may be responsible for the increasing in incidence and prevalence is that there's been a tremendous amount of work to get the diagnosis made sooner because we have some evidence that very early social and language treatment results in a somewhat better outcome. So. I think pediatricians are much more aware that if they see a child in their practice who's not giving eye contact and is late speaking, and most importantly, if the mother says there's something wrong here, even though the kid looks all right to the pediatrician, that they get a consultation at a much earlier age than they used to. So that means that there are more cases identified in a given geographic area, which is kind of how you do a prevalence.
So is there no real rise, do you think, in autism?
I don't know the answer to that, but...
Nobody knows the answer.
Yeah, because we hadn't anticipated that this would occur, so we don't have the data from 20 years ago that would allow us to answer that question, but there are even more issues. Another one is that we look for cases in more institutions and than we used to. So, for example, in the past, these surveys would not search for cases in a regular school that, for typically developing children, where you would find most of the kids with Asperger's syndrome.
Right. Let me just go to Dr. Schur, mm-hmm. Andy Schur, and do you agree? What do you think? Is there a rise, or do you think most of it is accounted for by these factors that Dr. Folstein is talking about?
Yeah, I agree with what Dr. Folstein just said. I mean, in addition to a broadening of diagnostic criteria, as well as the source of case identification, finding the cases for autism, and obviously there's also additional parameters involved. One of the things that was mentioned by Dr. Eric von Bohn that in an editorial that accompanied the CDC paper, he indicated that, for instance, the diagnosis of autism, the increase he called a diagnosis substitution. For instance, in some of the studies, you see an increase in the cases of autism being reported or diagnosed. But at the same time, you see a decrease in the case of mental retardation that's been reported. And in some papers, actually, the effects kind of cancel each other out.
So maybe the people are being moved from one category into another is what's happening.
Right.
Is autism a kind of mental retardation, or is it a kind of mental illness, or where does it fit with other things?
It's really a developmental disability. It's a neurological disorder, and so by definition, it has an organic component to it.
By organic, you mean a biological?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. So like other bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. You know, there is a genetic, a biological cause to these psychiatric disorders.
Right. But developmental delay, is that what we mean by mental retardation, a developmental delay? Or is it a more severe case of mental retardation is a different thing?
Well, mental retardation can be the result of many different causes.
That's a more imprecise term, I guess.
That's correct. I think that's a pretty broad term. I mean, autism itself is a fairly broad term that many scientists suspect encompasses many related but somewhat distinct disorders, but what is known is that they probably share a common genetic underpinning.
Right. What are some of these disorders? Tick off a few for me, and then we'll take a little break. And you
for
can
instance, Asperger's, as
Asperger's syndrome,
by, right? Rett syndrome, Fragile X syndrome. These are all fairly common. The disorder that are considered as part of the autism spectrum disorder.
The spectrum of things that come under the autism umbrella.
That's correct.
Okay, and which means they share certain features.
That's correct.
Certain genetic features too?
Well, phenotype, I mean, they might share certain genetic feature, but even though that has not been established to date.
Okay. We are talking this hour about autism. Autism is typically diagnosed in children between the ages of 1 and 2 years. That has led some parents of autistic children to question whether the many vaccines that children receive during those years might contribute to the disease in their children or even cause it. One small study published in 1998 in the British journal The Lancet pointed to the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine as one possible cause for the disease. But no large-scale studies have shown any connection. Other parents believe that a vaccine preservative called thimerosal, which contains mercury but is no longer used in vaccines, might have caused the disease. Joining me to talk more about vaccines and autism is Dr. Neil Halsey. He is the director of the Institute for Vaccine Safety at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. He joins us by phone from his office. Thanks for taking time to be with us, Dr. Halsey.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm happy to talk about this subject.
And you've done a lot of work, if I'm not mistaken, you've done a lot of work in with childhood vaccines and been involved in setting up how we do them and when we do them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so you're a good person to ask then. What about this link? A lot of parents, as you know, are very, very upset and concerned about it. Should they be?
Well, let me address first the question you raised about MMR vaccine, because I think we have the clearest answer to that question now. And it has been investigated in depth over the past 4 years since the issue was first raised by Dr. Wakefield through a number of studies.
That was the Lancet study and some others.
That's correct. And then several publications since then. But several expert groups have now carefully looked at that hypothesis that Dr. Wakefield raised, and I co-chaired with an expert on autism, Susan Hyman, a committee for the Academy of Pediatrics, and our findings were published in the May issue of Pediatrics of 2001. I'll just summarize very briefly that at that time, the evidence clearly did not support the hypotheses. There were many holes in the logic and the process that had been taken to reach the hypothesis, and the data that was available really was not supportive at all.
So you're talking about sort of technical issues in the way the study was done, that sort of thing?
That's correct. There are many epidemiologic flaws in the process that had been followed, and experts really looking at that and conducting other studies had found no evidence to support the hypothesis that there was an increased risk. But it's time now to put this question to rest, because I think definitive studies have now come out showing no temporal association between MMR and autism, as had been hypothesized by Dr. Wakefield and some others, both in the United Kingdom and in the United States. And perhaps the most definitive study was published in November in the New England Journal of Medicine by a group from Denmark, where they looked at over 500,000 children, of whom about 80%, over 440,000, had received MMR, and another 100,000 plus that had not, and found absolutely no difference in the frequency with which autism was diagnosed. And also, there was no temporal association in that population at all.
By temporal association, you mean what exactly?
For those children who received the vaccine, the timing of receiving the vaccine and the detection of the first signs or symptoms.
Right, like did it occur within 6 months of the vaccine or something like that?
One of the problems that has occurred here is a common problem that we have faced in other areas of science, and that is the common assumption that if something occurs that is bad and unexpected and unanticipated, we all look back to try to figure out what might have caused it. And things that have happened in the recent past, whether it be days, weeks, or months, we sometimes assume may have caused it. Well, that's an interesting hypothesis, but we really need to test those hypotheses with very good science. That's now been done, and I'm convinced that there is absolutely no association between MMR vaccine and autism, and it is time to move on.
Okay.
Beyond that hypothesis.
Now, the measles, mumps, rubella, you feel has been definitively refuted as a possible cause. The mercury containing preservative is a different question, though, a separate question. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And where do we stand on that one?
Well, first, to correct one common misperception, there never has been thimerosal, a preservative that did have a small amount of mercury in it, in MMR vaccine or the other live viral vaccines.
So MMR, it was the question of something about the vaccine itself.
Correct.
Was the question, which has been now refuted by these more recent studies. With some other vaccines, it was the question of this additive that was the question that was asked.
Yeah, is this
still in vaccines now? This is
thimerosal as a preservative has been removed from all of the vaccines that are being given to children under 6 months of age, all of the routinely recommended childhood vaccines.
Anywhere around the world that's the case?
No, that's true only in the United States and in most European countries. That is still being used in some European countries and in many developing countries. A preservative is needed for vaccines that have multiple doses in the same vial because the preservative inhibits the growth of bacteria. There are a couple of choices, and at the present time, the World Health Organization has not been able to make changes with regard to the multiple dose DTP vaccine in most developing countries because they have to use the multiple dose vials. But let's stay within the United States.
Okay, in the United States, it's gone.
Right.
Right.
The concern that was raised in 1999 stemmed from an investigation by the Food and Drug Administration where they were asked to look at mercury in all biologic products. And through that investigation, Leslie Ball, Robert Ball, and a third colleague, which I am embarrassed to forget his name, did uncover the fact that the total amount of exposure that a child might get in the first 6 months of age exceeded the EPA guidelines for mercury exposure for women of childbearing age and raised the possibility of a concern. When I and others looked at that, we also were concerned that children were getting this amount from several different vaccines at one time. Other studies are in place to try to determine whether or not there was any harmful effect from that, but because it was more mercury than was considered to be acceptable through at least one federal agency, rapid action was taken at the encouragement of several organizations, including the Academy of Pediatrics and multiple groups in the Public Health Service. And the manufacturers really did respond very quickly and have removed it from all of the routine vaccines given to very young children. And that's the age group that we were really concerned about. So the first message is parents should not be concerned about the vaccines that they're giving their children today, that there really is no thimerosal as a preservative in those vaccines. It's either been removed totally or removed 99.5% plus, so that there's not anything that I would be concerned about.
Right.
And the confusion that has occurred is that a relative of this form of mercury, a methylmercury, is present in many fish throughout the world, especially the predator fish where it is accumulated. And women who consume large amounts of those particular fish with a lot of mercury can have children who are affected adversely by the amount of mercury that is there. And that's detected through very careful studies showing mild learning disabilities, delayed speech, and so forth. When there has been massive exposure to methylmercury, there have been more severe neurologic impairment, such as some people may remember back in the early 1960s in Japan, and Iraq is another country where a major problem occurred. I think the only concern that exists now is whether or not there may have been a problem in the past with regard to these mild learning disabilities. Where the confusion occurs is that autism, as you have just been discussing with the others on this program, whether or not their autism is included in that group or it's totally separate. And I believe, as I have heard on your program, that it is a distinct and different entity. And the studies with methylmercury exposure have not reported any association with autism, and it is not something that's on my list as something that I believe is causally related.
Let me pause for just a moment to take a call here. We have a lot of eager...
All right, and then let me clarify one more point.
Sure. Okay, Maria from Kalamazoo, Michigan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the mother of a 5-year-old autistic son who was born in Kuwait. Emmett regressed at 26 months, 2 weeks after having a HIB vaccine, which I believe that all these kids are genetically predisposed.
That's
but we
the
need to...
hepatitis B
yes,
vaccine,
it is. It's
right.
Given as we were following the European protocol. They're now following the British, or they're now following the American protocol. It took 4 doctors to find someone who was familiar with autism in the U.S., and then he said that Emmett was too affectionate to be autistic. We went to a private speech-language pathologist, and we have a wonderful school in Kalamazoo, Croydon Avenue, who has an autistic-impaired classroom. And they have helped us, and he will be mainstreamed next year.
Did he receive that vaccine in Kuwait or in the U.S.?
Yes, he did.
Do you know whether that had thimerosal in it?
They all contained thimerosal. They were mostly shipped over from the U.S. And the amount of thimerosal in it, since they would have periodic outbreaks, they would revaccinate all the children in the country. So he was exposed to a lot of Tamiflu.
Now, is that that's your question, that whether that vaccine and the preservative might have played some role in his illness?
Well, we may have been genetically predisposed to it. I was there during the Gulf War, so I don't know what I was exposed to there. But I would, you know, we need to doctors to know that just because you say autism, it does not mean that there is nothing to do. A Dr. Michael Ches, a neurologist in Chicago, is helping patients with a supplement he has called Carnivore. As I say, the school.
Right, we're going to talk about treatment, but let me have Dr. Halsey talk about your question with the with that vaccine and whether that might be an issue. Thanks for calling, Maria. Dr. Halsey, go ahead. What about that situation? Is that your understanding that a vaccine given overseas might contain thimerosal?
Well, some vaccines in most countries may very well have contained thimerosal. I would not be concerned at all about a single dose of any vaccine given to a child at around 26 weeks of age. By that time, they're older and their brains are further developed. There is a decreased susceptibility with increasing age and their larger body mass where these are administered. So a single dose of one vaccine does not concern me. And I think the only problem was that in the U.S. we were sometimes using as many as three different vaccines at the same time that may have contained it. I do believe that the caller has identified a problem that all parents face when something like this happens, and that is the temporal association that they make and the connection and the assumption that it may very well have been that event that occurred shortly before. And that's something that we have learned to address with the science of causality assessment for vaccines. And we do need to make sure we understand that a temporal association is really only a hypothesis. It does not provide strong evidence in favor of a causal relationship because there are so many other coincidental events. And I'm certain there are many other events that took place in this child's life and all of the other children that one could also hypothesize may have played a role. So we have to be cautious about that. That's exactly the problem we ran into with MMR and autism.
The problem it sounds to me is that what parents are this connection that they're making is sort of plausible and reasonable in a certain way. I mean, their child gets a vaccine and some short time later comes down with this illness. So it's a sort of first guess, as you say, a hypothesis that I think any of us would make in those circumstances.
That's correct.
That's why it attracts so much interest and staying power, I guess.
Sure, but that's why we need to do careful studies of children who are exposed and not exposed to different vaccines or different doses and different amounts, let's say, of the thimerosal. Those studies are in place now, and it'll probably be another year before we have a definitive answer, but studies are being done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health. And I realize everybody would like answers today, but I think we'll have more definitive answers about a year from now. But the preliminary data from one large study that was done did not show any evidence of an increased risk of autism. It did show a concern about a possible increased risk in one of two populations of milder learning disabilities, but that has to be examined in more detail and with a careful examination of these children. And that is taking place now.
Right. Let me pause for just a moment to remind everyone that I am Paul Rayburn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Yeah, I think what you're saying is a reminder to all of us why our tax dollars and the government and various other groups spend a lot of money to do these kinds of studies, because of the many, many things that seem plausible and possible and reasonable. Some of them turn out to be true when they're carefully investigated, and some don't, and that's why we do these things, I guess.
That's correct, and we're learning a lot about how to do these studies best, and I have confidence that we will be able to provide very definitive answers to these questions. And at the same time, other studies are being done on autism research to try to look for other factors that may predispose, in addition to the genetics that has been mentioned many times now. And who knows, we may find additional factors. For instance, we do know that children born to women who got rubella early in pregnancy are damaged in many ways, but also those children are at increased risk of autism. If their mother had rubella early in pregnancy, I don't remember the precise risk, but it's markedly elevated risk of developing autism or autism spectrum disorder. We now prevent almost all of those cases by giving rubella vaccine to all children.
Is there any evidence that there are many parents who are refusing to have their children vaccinated because of this autism fear?
Well, there was a problem in the United Kingdom where the acceptance of MMR did decline, and there were outbreaks. There was a significant outbreak in Ireland with several deaths and encephalitis associated with it. In the United States, fortunately, I think that the science has come along in time, and that we have not seen a significant decline. I'm certain there are some parents who have not accepted the vaccine, but there has not been a significant drop in the acceptance of MMR vaccine or other vaccines.
We have just a little bit of time left, but has it been difficult for you as a big proponent and a person who has done a lot to encourage vaccination to hear these kinds of things said about the work you've done?
Well, I think the important thing that parents and everybody needs to know is that we all need to be working to make vaccines as safe as possible. And I have been a proponent of using vaccines to prevent illness, but I've also been a strong proponent of making sure we use the safest vaccines that are available. And it doesn't disturb me too much to hear the concerns that parents have, because we need voices to raise questions and for us to be able to investigate them and to be demanding that we constantly are evaluating and looking for the safest vaccines. Take a look at some progress with just one half a second, if I could. We've changed over from the oral polio vaccine that used to cause paralysis in about 8 children every year in this country, and we now use an inactivated vaccine that protects as well, but doesn't cause that.
That will have to be the last word. We're out of time. Thanks very much for being with us, Dr. Halsey. Dr. Neil Halsey is director of the Institute for Vaccine Safety at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Paul Rayburn. This hour, we're talking about autism. My guests are Andy Shure, Director of Research and Programs for the National Alliance for Autism Research, and Susan Folstein, Director of the Autism Genetics Cooperative. She is also Professor of Psychiatry at the Tufts University Medical School, a New England Medical Center. And let's start with a question from one of our listeners. We have Jill in San Jose, California. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm the mother of a 4-year-old boy with what they call classic autistic disorder. I mean, he's mostly nonverbal. He can't play, no interest in toys, etc. And when he was born with a very large head. And by the time he was 12 months old, his head was even larger. And what I've since found out, he was diagnosed after he turned 2, by the way. What I since have found out is that there is a significant body of research that indicates that this large head size is correlated with autism. And I wanted to know what your guests think of this research.
So he was born with a large head, but it was not until 2 years later that he was diagnosed with autism.
Right, right. He was significantly delayed, I think, his whole life, but through a combination of denial and just not really knowing what autism was, we didn't figure out what it was until he was 2. And the pediatrician who noted his huge head ordered a CT scan, which was normal, and he didn't really have an idea that the head size could be correlated
right.
with autism.
Susan Folstein, is there any reason to think there might be a connection there?
Yes, I think that's quite well established now. In fact, Kanner mentioned it in his original paper in 1943, but that sort of got lost and has been rediscovered in recent years. Children with autism, and I think it's now probably clear that it's limited to boys, have the same distribution shape, that is, from, you know, between X centimeters and Y centimeters, a broad range of head scores, but it's shifted toward bigger heads. And we've also recently published a paper that suggested that the parents and some of the siblings have also got a larger head size.
What's going on with their brains, or what do we think might be going on biologically there?
Mm-hmm. Well, it may be, you know, we don't think that autism is caused by just one gene, and there are probably different mixes of genes in different families, but my hypothesis is that there is a gene that controls the way the brain develops, which results in a bigger head size. So it may be related, for example, to the fact that you grow too many neurons or too many synapses, or that you don't prune enough back. So if this caller is correct in that when you do a CT scan, it looks normal. So they don't have big ventricles or hydrocephalus or anything. They have too much brain tissue. And some evidence suggests that this is more in the temporal lobes.
Mm-hmm. Does that help, Jill?
Yes, it does. And I wanted to ask particularly about the research of Dr. Cortezny, I believe it's pronounced in...
Corshane, sorry,
mm-hmm. At University of California in San Diego. He's done a bunch of MRI research on young boys, particularly with autism, and he has found what he's calling this growth dysregulation hypothesis.
That's correct.
Yeah. And he said that could account for the regression, that at some point the circuits are pretty normal, and then within the first year at some point the circuits become disorganized and abnormal, which parents see as regression and which could also correspond to you know, what they see as a relation to the vaccine in terms of the timing. It's really just the brain growing in an abnormal fashion.
Is Jill giving us a good summary of the research, Dr. Falstein?
Yes, she is. It's... Most of the children are born with heads within the normal range, although some of them are already big at birth. But the rate of growth of heads is greater than it should be during the first 3 or 4 years of life, actually. And we don't really know what the correlates are. There's one paper I know in press where the children with large heads tend to have a very big discrepancy in their verbal and performance IQ. That's Robert Joseph at Boston University. That is, they have much higher nonverbal IQs than verbal IQs. But this is all kind of dancing around the same hypotheses that things are still within normal limits, perhaps, at the time of birth, but as the brain continues to grow and make synapses and prune synapses and so on, it doesn't happen correctly. And so this leap that occurs, for example, in language and socialization at about 18 to 20 months, where they just don't make this leap. So this is the parents sometimes first notice it at that time, but I must point out that it's not usually the first symptom. I think one of the callers was saying was diagnosed later because of denial, and in part, and that is, it's very difficult for parents to face the fact that their child is developing abnormally. But the main point is that features are usually present in the first year of life. There have been a number of studies looking at videotapes from first birthday parties that where you can clearly distinguish the autistic children from the control children, even though you aren't told, of course, as the rater, which is which.
Right. Thanks
for calling, Jill.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Andy Scher, we mentioned briefly Asperger's, some of these other disorders. I think Fragile X may be another one. Can you tell us a little bit about these other things on the spectrum of autistic disorders, what they are and what they look like?
Well, conditions such as Fragile X and Rett syndrome, they share many what we call phenotype or symptoms with autism, such as socialization issues and communications issues.
That withdrawn characteristic that we talked about.
That is correct. However, there is an important distinction at this point. Both Fragile X and Rett syndrome have been identified in terms of the genetic cause. And the gene for Rett's, for instance, is called MECP2, which is a protein that regulates expression of other genes.
That one we know the gene.
That's Rett's. Correct.
Or the gene or one of the genes?
It's one gene.
It's one gene in that
right.
case.
And for Fragile X, there's also been a gene identified called FMR1, and that's responsible for the shedding of RNA in and out of the cell nucleus. How those disorders differ from what we commonly call autism is that, as Dr. Susan mentioned earlier, is that scientists mostly believe now that it's multiple genes are involved, many genes, maybe as many as 10 to 20 genes are involved that makes up what we call autism at this point.
So does that mean that these various disorders, some of these 10 or 20 might be active or inactive in some disorders and others of the 10 or 20 in others, or is it that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think as Dr. Fosen has pointed out earlier, is that it depends on the family and depends on the individual. There may very well be that that they have a different cocktail or different mixture of different genes that have something amiss with them.
Right. Now, one of my favorite movies that I'm sure some of our listeners have thought about too is Rain Man.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on there? Was that some sort of autism, or was that a fictional thing that wasn't quite anything? Because it was a very compelling and dramatic portrayal of something.
Right.
What do you make of that?
I mean, I think that's Rain Man definitely, you know, I think increased public awareness of the disorder. But the case depicted in that movie is, I would say, is really atypical, because the character played by Dustin Hoffman is probably high functioning autistic and with savant skills. His ability to count cars, for instance.
Right.
And this usually account this kind of savant skills and high functioning, a high IQ and so on, usually only account for a very small fraction of the community.
Doesn't that sometimes occur in children with Asperger's syndrome, that they will?
Yes, especially children with Asperger's syndrome. And I think they're one of the things that is often noticed about children with Asperger's is that, you know, they have a tremendous ability to, for example, to memorize the weather pattern or football team scores and so
they
on.
They will
so
have unusually strong or abnormally positive aspects to
Absolutely.
their illness. I can't quite
right.
get that out. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let me pause for just a moment to say that I'm Paul Rayburn. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Susan Folstein, we've talked a lot about the genetic components, various things. Do we have, aside from Rett syndrome, where we have a gene in hand, do we have any of these 10 or 20 genes in hand? And if not, when will we actually track them down?
We don't really have any in hand for sure. We have some that are very that have been identified in some studies, but not in a very large number of children. So we need a lot more work to be sure that there really are important genes. But I wanted also to make a distinction between autism and its cause. So we're talking about Rett syndrome and Fragile X, which are both single gene conditions that are caused by only one gene. And autism, and those children have autism very often. Now, we would leave those children out of our genetic studies, because what we're looking for are cases with no particular single gene condition, such as the ones we've mentioned, or tuberous sclerosis, or Down syndrome, or any chromosomal abnormalities. And when you take cases of that nature, and who also don't have any dysmorphic features, that is, they don't have a look as if they had some genetic abnormality. These are often called beautiful children.
Right.
When you take those cases, you still get you get a very particular kind of familial pattern. You don't get a very high rate of two affected siblings, but if you look at identical twins, you get quite a high rate. So when you have a pattern like that, where the identical twins have a very high rate, and the fraternal twins and siblings have a very small rate, it's usually going to be caused by a number of genes working together.
Right. We're getting short on time, but I did want to give you an opportunity. You are looking for families with children with autism for these studies. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
How do people find you if they want to participate in the studies?
Well,
you have a website?
You may have our websites on your links.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, and you can give us the website on the air if
okay.
you have it handy.
Autism Genetic Research, all one string.
Okay, and that can also be found at www.sciencefriday.com.
Right, and so. We also have another website that is just to educate families about the genetics of autism, and that's called exploringautism.org.
Okay. All right, well...
And I think that link is on there, too.
Yeah.
But to give you a short answer to your question, we don't have, but this cooperative that I've been fostering over the last 2 years...
The Autism Genetics Cooperative, right?
Yes, is now at the point of putting all our families together, and we have perhaps up to 1,000 families where there are at least 2 affected children. And with this huge number, we hope to be able to identify the chromosomal intervals where there are sure to be autism genes.
Things are looking good.
Very good.
We'll have to stop right there. I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Andy Scherr, Director of Research and Programs for the National Alliance for Autism Research.
Thank you.
Susan Folstein, Director of the Autism Genetics Cooperative, which we just mentioned, also Professor of Psychiatry at the Tufts University Medical School, New England Medical Center. Earlier, we spoke to Neil Halsey, Director of the Institute for Vaccine Safety at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thanks to all of you for joining me today. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello in New York and John Hoder in Boston. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. You can email us for further information or to give us your comments at scifry@npr.org or surf over and visit the website www.sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in New York, I'm Paul Rayburn.